As far back as 1982, Douglas said that it was important to him to do something different because he didn't want to be associated just with hitchhikers for his entire career. One of the ideas he came up with was the creation of a new hero, Dirk Gently, and the first novel, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, was eventually published in late May 1987. To launch the novel in the UK, Douglas appeared on Radio 4's Bookshelf, where he was interviewed by Susan Hill.
Now, I don't know about you, but before settling down to read a book, I often flick through the pages in advance to see what it's going to be like. And it was while doing this the other day that on page 111 of a novel I was really looking forward to reading, I came across the following advertisement. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. We solve the whole crime. We find the whole person. Phone today for the whole solution to your problem. Missing cats and messy divorces a speciality. I didn't seem to need the service of a holistic detective agency, but my curiosity got the better of me, so I decided to dial the advertised phone number and see what would happen.
Hello. You have reached the offices of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Or rather, you have reached an advertisement for it. If you'd like to leave a message after the beep, you can't. There isn't going to be one. This is Douglas Adams.
That was Douglas Adams. His new novel, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, has several apparently unconnected plots freewheeling along simultaneously. There are some real locations, a Cambridge college, a street in London's Islington, and some very unreal ones that could only exist in a fantasy world. There's a ghost with an identity crisis, a computer expert suspected of murder, and a Don with a time machine, and I'm making it sound far more confusing than it really is. Fans of Douglas Adams will know that the only thing to do is to put yourself trustingly into his hands.
Where did you read that?
A book.
Which book was that?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, that thing.
You've thrown off The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy
at last. Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, I've been doing it for 10 years. I mean, I actually got to the stage where I'd completely forgotten what it was I intended to do in the first place. I only knew what I was there doing at sort of everybody else's demand. Mm-hmm. I actually did one book too many of them anyway, largely because I had a terrible experience living in Los Angeles working on the movie of Hitchhiker. Which movie of Hitchhiker, you may ask, and I have very much the same question to ask. So I think coming home after a very dispiriting year, it was the first thing that had sort of gone sort of really wrong as far as Hitchhiker was concerned. And I knew I should then do something different. But there was a certain amount of sort of running for shelter, I think.
Where did Dirk Gently come from?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's not...
I mean, was he somebody who'd been hanging around in the back of your mind for years?
Vaguely. I mean, I tend to have lots and lots of notebooks with odd sort of half ideas sitting waiting to be put together with something which will make it a whole idea then. And I suppose, I mean, the attraction of something sort of vaguely in the detective genre is that I think it's very well suited for what I happen to do, which is this thing of putting the very, very ordinary next to the very, very extraordinary, which is where I like operating best. And what frequently happens in detective novels is that the very, very extraordinary happens, and then by unravelling it and seeing it from different perspectives, you suddenly see that it's actually something very ordinary that's happened.
Yes, an example of that, mixing the ordinary and the extraordinary, is where he's in Cambridge the night he goes to dinner, your hero, Richard Macduff.
I think you're talking about the horse in the bathroom.
Yes.
Which was... I loved writing that bit, actually. It was tremendous fun when he goes up. When Richard Macduff is told that there's a horse in the bathroom, and he thinks the guy is completely mad, and he goes up to look for himself. And I loved doing that long, long description of all the sort of rather boring features of the bathroom.
If you wonder why Douglas enjoyed writing that scene, here's John Lloyd on their flat-sharing days, post-Cambridge.
We rented this small house in Roehampton, and it was a very strange furnished house. I remember Douglas had 7 wardrobes in his bedroom, and he'd sit in this bedroom with the 7 wardrobes and get terribly depressed and then think, I'll have a bath. And quite often I'd come back, and he'd still be in the bath.
Taking so many baths was, as we now know, Probably a novel form of displacement activity for putting off writing, no matter how Douglas liked to wrap it up.
It always used to be that a writer would always sort of sharpen his pencils, buy new notepads, and sort of clean the fridge. And actually, cleaning the fridge has always been a problem, because when you start to clean the fridge, you always become terribly interested by a lot of the things you find in it, and they sort of prey on your mind all day, and you keep on wandering down to just check that everything in the fridge is all right. And of course, by the end of the day, the fridge is, of course, completely clean, but you're having more difficulty getting up and downstairs. In my case, it was always a bath. I always had lots and lots of baths, so I was convinced that I had my best ideas in the bath, so I'd get up in the morning, have a bath, and then you sort of wait there until you had a good idea. And then, of course, by the time you'd got out of the bath and toweled yourself dry and got dressed and gone and checked things in the fridge, you'd forgotten what the idea was, so you had to go and have another bath in order to remind yourself.
So, with all these long hours spent in the bath, it must have been a simple case of memory recall for Douglas to come up with this rather telling description, read by Ian Thompson.
The bathroom was not large. The walls were panelled in old oak linen fold, which, given the age and nature of the building, was quite probably priceless. But otherwise, the fittings were stark and institutional. There was old, scuffed, black-and-white linoleum on the floor, a small basic bath, well-cleaned but with very elderly stains and chips in the enamel, and also a small basic basin, with a toothbrush and toothpaste in a Duralex beaker standing next to the taps. Screwed into the probably priceless panelling above the basin was a tin mirror-fronted bathroom cabinet. There was an old cream-painted wooden cupboard standing in the corner, with an old brown bentwood chair next to it, on which lay some neatly folded but threadbare small towels. There was also a large horse in the room.
You've got all sorts of strange elements popping in and out. I mean, there is this man who dies.
All right.
And becomes a ghost,
right,
or a spirit, or
whatever
you like to
call it. Well, yes, the ghost story aspect of it. I mean, I'd never, ever come across a ghost story written from the point of view of the ghost. And what I particularly liked about that character was the idea that the moment he had died, he actually didn't know what to do next. Because we all assume, I mean, whatever we may debate about what we think is going to happen in the afterlife, or whether there is an afterlife, at least we assume we will know once it happens.
Mm. And there's this other strange character on a horse. This
Well, the electric monk is simply a sort of device for believing things for you, you know, which is something which is an increasing problem for us. And I say that, you know, just as we have dishwashers to wash all our dishes that we can't be bothered to do, and we have video recorders to watch television and save us the bother of doing it. So we now have electric monks which believe things for us, and that's free us from the responsibility of believing all the things that we're expected to.
I'd like to drag you back to reality for a minute, because there are some very real things in it. I mean, there's Cambridge, which is a real place, but there's Islington, where you live, isn't there?
That's right.
I mean, well, absolutely real. Mm. Real shops, the things that are actually there. I mean, is there a real Peckender Street?
No, there isn't. I mean, that was invented. Actually, where Dirk's place is in fact completely fictitious. But certainly, I mean, just exactly around where I live, yes, I mean, I do use it because, I mean, oh, somebody said to me the other day, you know, are you trying to mythologise Islington? And I'm absolutely not. It's just if you're going to set it in London, you may as well set it where you live
because you
know it. I mean, there's no point in setting it in Putney if I then got to sort of get a bus down to Putney to see what the layout is.
How carefully did you work it out in detail in advance? Is the whole graph filled in?
Well, the problem I find is that whenever I do work things out in great detail, because one of my sort of main impetuses is to be funny, very often you'll write a scene and it doesn't work in one way or another. And the only way to make it work is to introduce some other completely spurious element or turn it on its head or whatever. And at the end of that, you've now got a scene that works, but your plot has gone out of the window. So you have to come up with a new plot to account for what you've just done in this scene. And then the next scene you write, you have the same problem again. So after a while, you just begin to be suspicious of your plans for the way the book goes. But nevertheless, what I am determined is that I will get better at the plotting, and I will become better at writing the scene I meant to write and making it work.
A second Dirk Gently book, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, followed a year later after another tortuous battle with deadlines. But apart from a stage production by Oxford students in 1995, Dirk Gently was sadly destined to detect no more.